Heavy, an American memoir by author and professor Kiese Layman, is a story that's stirring of a young black Mississippi boy's development into manhood in an excellent black family, one that, not unlike other excellent black families, does not confront their issues head on, but secretly carries their weight. This weight, carried along with the systemic issues of racism and bias in the American South, becomes the obstruction constricting the flow of functional love. Heavy, an American memoir, does and deals with the complicated issues of the relationship one black family has with violence, food, and the challenges of creating and maintaining functional expressions of love and care, and how those elements shape the rearing of a black Southern boy by the women of his family, most prominently his mother. Kiese Layman is on the line to discuss his new book, Heavy, an American Memoir, today on this edition of The Keenest Observers. Kiese Layman is a black Southern writer born and raised in Jackson, Mississippi. Layman attended Millsaps College and Jackson State University before graduating from Oberlin College. He earned an MFA in fiction from Indiana University. Layman is currently the Ottilie Schillick Professor of English and Creative Writing at the University of Mississippi. He served as the Distinguished Visiting Professor of Nonfiction at the University of Iowa in fall 2017. Layman is the author of the novel Long Division and a collection of essays, How to Slowly Kill Yourself and Others in America. He has written extensively essays, stories, and reviews from numerous publications, including Esquire, McSweeney's, New York Times, ESPN The Magazine, Color Lines, NPR, and a host of others. He also, with Heavy in October, I'm sorry, in later in 2019, will have a novel called And So On that will also be released by Scribner. Kiese Layman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here with y'all.
Most definitely, most definitely. I am going to tell you, I feel late to the party. I am feeling rather embarrassed by that. Heavy hit me like a ton of bricks. And I'll say that to start because I believe that there are a grouping of Gen X and Gen Y brothers just like you that need this book.
Yes.
And I wonder if you've heard from them yet to begin our conversation. Before I even ask you what this book is about from your perspective.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. That's a great question to start. Yeah, I mean, and I think that's one of the things I've been most surprised about. Like, I have been hearing from, definitely from a lot of, like, what you call Gen X, Gen Y brothers and sisters. But a lot of young people, too, you know what I mean? A lot of young people, teenagers have been hitting me about this book, which is on one hand great, but on another hand scary, right? Because it means that, you know, some of the trials and trauma that we wade through aren't just generational, you know what I mean? Like, they actually happen to young folks, to old folk, to middle-aged folk. And so I've been grateful that everybody reached out and talked to me about what they want to talk about. But the flip side is that, like, you know, I wrote this book, but I'm not a psychiatrist, not a psychologist.
Yeah,
you know
yeah,
what I'm saying?
Yes.
So, like, people are coming to me often with stories that are so heartwarming, so heart-wrenching, but I'm not often sure. And they're looking for me to give them a diagnosis. And yeah, I don't really know what to say other than, like, yo, you American. That's what we got to deal with. We got to deal with that, you know?
Yeah, I'm not even going to play. You know, I had the most, I read your book, and then I had to step away from it for at least 6 days before
wow.
I even started prepping it, because it was such an alignment with my own personal walk as a mother, you know, an academic mother, you know, dealing, with
wow.
nationalists. I mean, we're going to have to talk offline. I'm not going to take a lot of your time offline, but it was literally, you know, like talking to a facet of a brother who had comparable, you know, had a comparable line in a slightly later time. I'm a solid Xer, but I think you hit upon the raw challenges of what it is to be in America, walking in black identified bodies, male or female, or in the middle, and what that is. So can you tell me in your own words then, what is this book about?
I mean, you know, man, at its root, the book is about a black boy trying to talk to his mother about secrets and lies and joys that he should have talked to her about years ago, but he couldn't. At its root, that's what it's about. You know, I'm trying to talk to my mama about the things that made us, about the things that we both saw but never talked about. and really about what that has to do with the making of a nation and the making of a region. You know what I mean? Because I'm from the Deep South, from Mississippi. Specifically, Mississippi gets, you know, joked about often as being last and everything else. And partially my mama's, like stringent adherence to excellence comes from, yes, because she's a black woman, but also because she was a black woman born in the middle of central Mississippi. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So mm-hmm. she really believed, because we came from a state that was seen as so mediocre, that, and because we're black folk, that the way we combat that is through utter excellence. And every time I saw that utter excellence wasn't protecting us, you know, she didn't talk about it, I didn't talk about it. There's a lot of things that involve sexual intimacy we didn't talk about. So it's really just an attempt to have conversations, again, that we should have had, and to open and to say to my mama, mama, I want, you know, if you want to talk to me, let's please talk. I think we're heavier together, much heavier together than we are separately. Let's please do this together, because I don't think I can do it alone.
Right, right. I think for viewers who are going to pick up the book, and I suggest that you do, Kiese literally writes the book to his mother. So yeah. Structurally, there'll be points where he addresses his mother, you, in points as the memoir goes out into your consciousness. We have a few seconds left in this segment, but I want to kind of get into why you decided to write directly to your mother, and why you decided to call this an American memoir. And we'll kind of cover that on the backside. We have Kiese Lehman with us. His new book, Heavy, has just dropped. Stick with us. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Robert Goodwin, and we're talking to author Kiese Lehman about his new book, Heavy, an American Memoir. You are welcome to join this conversation. You can call us at 800-838-3760 or email comments and questions to jx@jeffnet.org. Kiese, we were getting into how you've structured the book as a, I guess you could say, not even a letter, but a communication to your mother as you go back in time. How did that idea come to you, and why did you think it was like the way to structure the book?
Yeah, you know what? The book started off as a weight loss book. I was going to lose 150 pounds talking to my mom and my grandma about their relationships to food and yeah. violence. And, you know, along the way, I was just like, man, these are wonderful stories they're telling, but they're just not true. And so I just started to think a lot about lies in our family. And I was like, you know, you want to do this book justice, you need to sort of scrap the weight loss aspect of it and sort of focus on, like, the familial impact of lies. And so I wrote one chapter to my mom, one chapter to my grandma, one chapter to my imaginary daughter, one chapter to my ex-partner. And then the hardest chapter to write was the chapter to my mom, because that was my mom. You know, we were the closest. She was my best friend growing up. She was my archenemy growing up. She's responsible for my writerly practice. So I was just like, just, you know, you don't know if you're going to be alive tomorrow. Just try to do what you haven't seen done before. So I tried to write it to my mom, directly addressed to my mom, which made the book scarier, you know. And it's called an American memoir because, you know, again, I'm trying to say a lot of things. What I'm trying to say, like a lot of American memoirs, I think, are kind of encouraged to end with this sort of like resolution or discovery or like a progress narrative. And this isn't that story. Like, there's a lots of resolutions that get upended. And I wanted to say it is at once, America's at once responsible for this book, but also wanted this book to expand what is possible from an American memoir. So I'm in debt to America for this book, but I'm also trying to broaden the range of what Americanness can mean in this memoir to lessen the debt for other people who want to come after me.
Right, right. I want to read really quickly the I guess what could be called as the preface, but you call it Ben. It says, I did not want to write to you. I wanted to write a lie. I did not want to write honestly about black lies, black thighs, black loves, black laughs, black foods, black addictions, black stretch marks, black dollars, black words, black abuses, black blues, black belly buttons, black wins, black bends, black consent, black parents or black children. I did not want to write about us. I wanted to write an American memoir. I wanted to write a lie. I wanted to do that old black work of pandering and lying to folk who pay us to pander and lie to them every day. I wanted to write about our families, relationships, to simple carbohydrates, deep fried meats, and high fructose corn syrup. I wanted the book to begin with me weighing 319 pounds and end up with my weighing 165 pounds. I wanted to pepper the book with acerbic warnings to us fat black folk in the Deep South and saccharine sentimental exhortations from Grandmama. I did not want you to laugh. I wanted to write a lie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds good when you read it, man.
Thank you. Thank you,
good
man.
When you read it.
Hey, it sounded good when you read it, too. I just wanted to say that. But I think that that's an interesting prospect to consider. As a lot of us contend with how lies then equal comfort, especially comfort in food. And then comfort in the food that is the comfort of not only family challenge and trauma, but also what it is to be in America, an American, and a black American dealing with all of that. And it was very interesting hearing and seeing your mother kind of navigate that with you. And so she got you to write, right?
She got me to write. I mean, she gave me a lot of things. She got me to read and write. And it's difficult. So I'm playing with the book. In the book about what happens when you grow up in a black family like mine, where reading and writing is, of course, something you're supposed to do to discover the world beyond your region, but also it was what my mama used to punish, she beat me, too, but she would often, if I did something messed up, I had to go write an essay, I had to go read a book I didn't want to read or something like that, so that's why, there's that repetition of I will, because also at school, we messed up. Sometimes we would get whippings at school, but we also had to write lines, and the lines were always future tense, right? I will follow directions. I will pay attention in class. And so I just wanted to, play again with, the ways we use language sometimes to discipline all bodies in this country, but in particular, black bodies down here, and flip it. You know what I mean? Flip it and not write a book that is trying to discipline anybody, but write a book that is trying to reckon with what the consequences of that discipline are on our bodies and our relationships to each other.
Yeah, you talk a lot about construct in black families of whippings and how those whippings can be discipline, but also can be a way of assuaging the pain of the whipper. If, I can
Absolutely.
Have a kind of an extension of the thought.
Yep.
And how did that affect you, and how is that a part, and why is that a part, so such a big part of the book?
I mean, it's a big part of the book. One, because, it's just something I remember. I remember almost every whipping I got from my mom, and I got a lot. And the thing I remember most was that, there were times when she literally was trying to hit me as hard as she could. So to write this book, I had to think about what was going on in my mama's body and with my mama's imagination to feel that sometimes hitting her child as hard as she could was going to save him. And some of that had to do with, again, what was going on in Mississippi in terms of white supremacy, in terms of carcerality. But, you dig deeper, you see some of that had to do with, the way my mother was being abused by structures, by partners, really also by an inability to reckon with where she had been. And, it just gets passed on. And what I'm also trying to say, though, is I'm not trying to just do this thing I see a lot of people doing where you just talk about people punishing black bodies with belts and shoes, because that's one form of abuse. But there's also emotional abuse that comes along with a lot of that, too. You know what I'm saying? So I just really wanted to think about the ways that people who love each other, purport to love one another in this country, often just do the most harm to each other, but also want to talk about how and why. And if we can not just change it, but really understand it together.
Right. I think you do such a fabulous job in putting that in construct and in a really clear construct under the auspices of America, the South, and then family, because your family was loving and you think you really communicate that really well. But as most, you know, I'm not going to say most, that's not accurate, and I don't know that much, but I know a lot of Black families who in the midst of that love don't know how to be expressive and don't know how to communicate through discipline, communicate through the challenges of systemic issues, you know, in America or trauma or their past. Mm-hmm. And so there's the piece that is the communication vessel, you know, is lost. And so this is why I think this, your piece is such a seminal bridge for a lot of folk, because it talks about what it is to continue to come to the table and digest and dialogue. And so I guess I'm getting to this question, which is, do you find yourself and your family continuing to desire to come to the table after this memoir?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, like, my family's just like most families in that we want the first hard conversation to be the last hard conversation. You know, we want to be like, we had that conversation. And with this book, one, because it's so public, these conversations can't just be had one time. You know what I'm saying? So there are conversations my family needed to have, for example, around gambling. And we just wouldn't have it. We kept seeing, like, the consequences of, like, a familial addiction to gambling, but we never talked about it really. This book gave us an opportunity to talk and come back to the table and talk and come back to the table and talk and not pat ourselves on the back for talking and realizing that we really need to talk about it every day. Because what my family did before this book is, instead of talking about various forms of addiction or abuse, we would be like, oh, did you eat any wheat bread? Did you eat any white bread today? How many steps did you get? You know, all those are important questions, I guess. But it's interesting that those questions sometimes serve as a proxy for the really important questions that we evade. So I was just like, okay, let's talk about high fructose corn syrup. Let's talk about not drinking Coke. Let's talk about how we should probably eat less bread and sugar. And let's talk about how diabetes is ravaging our family. Sure, but let's also talk about all these other things that are actually encouraging that kind of consumption. And also, let's talk about starving, which is something everybody in my family has done. Let's talk about wanting to harm ourselves, which is something everybody in our family has done. You know what I'm saying? So I just wanted to extend conversations that our bodies, I think, wanted to have, but our mouths were too afraid to engage with.
Right. And I think for the audience, this memoir is literally a memoir. It comes from Kiese's life, from a youth, from 12 to professorship, right? Yeah. And it goes into sections: boy, man, Black abundance, homeworked, and addict Americans. And it goes from his, you know, rearing, and then goes all the way to a very, very, wow. I'm a be, you know, probably a cliche and say raw section about the gambling addiction that, you know, your mother dealt with as well as you dealt with in the midst of what could be said as your, you know, your a successful moment in your life.
Oh, for sure, man. I mean, yeah, you know, like when I became a professor, it was weird because I played a lot of basketball throughout my life. And I remember when I moved to Poughkeepsie to start ball, playing ball around there, nobody would call me by my name. They'd just be like, professor, you know? So it meant that, like, even in that mostly Black working class community, I had, like, a presence. One, because I was a new brother from in town who was balling with people who had been there for years, but also because I was a professor at the elite college in the town. But, again, what I'm trying to say is, like, what's the consequences sometimes for gaining these spaces and access to these spaces that people tell us are going to give us so much? You know what I'm saying? And so, you know, I starved myself when I first got. I kept starving myself when I first got my job. I got down to 2% body fat. I ran my legs like off to where they couldn't work anymore. And when my legs stopped working, I needed that feeling of euphoria that I got from like starving. So I started trying to eat a lot again, and got that terrible sense of euphoria. And then the other thing I found that gave me that terrible, terrifying euphoria was gambling. You know what I mean? Like, I just really was going to the casino every weekend to try to creatively lose my money and come back sad. because that was like, and like I felt full when that happened in this terrifying way, which, you know, you started taking out these like payday loans, which have like terrifying interest rates, and you know, you start lying to partners because you can't be honest about like the fact that you're working really hard, but you're giving all your money away to a machine. And meanwhile, my mama and other people in my family were going through the same thing. And I saw it in my mom because she was trying to get money from me. But my mama didn't see it in me. Mm. You know, I go to a casino sometime. We went and we hadn't talked in years because she moved up north. I go to a casino sometime. We hadn't really talked. And I'd see her at a slot machine. And I was too caught up in the gambling moment to even talk to her. My fear was like, oh, shit, let me run away, because if she sees me, she's going to want to talk to me. And if she talks to me, I'm going to have to leave, and I can't gamble. If I can't gamble, I can't lose everything. And if I can't lose everything, I can't go home feeling terrible. So that's what I wanted to write about, because it was and the fact that it happened during a time that in theory was supposed to be the most successful, joyful time of my life and career. Is interesting. But again, what I'm also trying to say is academia, you know, it's not all sweet up in there. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm a professor. I'm thankful. I believe in the life of mom. I believe education is the key to liberation. Real talk. But it's not all sweet in these academic institutions, particularly, I think, for black bodies that have been trained to be excellent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my mother used to say that academia is a jungle and you need to prepare yourself and move through it. Accordingly,
your mama right. that's just what it is. But you can't. But the thing is, also, what makes it hard to interrogate is like, you can't. It's hard to complain about that. Well, my grandmama grew up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my grandmama made a way for us working in chicken plants and cleaning white people's houses. You know what I'm saying? You know, I got friends who literally are dutifully, you know, being garbage women and garbage men. You know what I mean? Like, so. It's hard. You feel like, damn, I can't complain about this job, where my job really is to read, write, teach, and serve.
Exactly, exactly. I'm talking to Kiese Lehman, and we're talking about his new book, Heavy, an American Memoir. I think that's an interesting line. I want to make sure that we know. Like, you grew up an athlete, but an athlete in a big body, and I think that... plot line, that narrative line, I shouldn't say plot because it's real, narrative line in the book is a really interesting juxtaposition to each part of the life, that part of your life that you explore. You know, you talk about being a big 12-year-old, but then you constantly are like running miles and doing push-ups.
Yeah.
To balance out all through your life, and you
yep.
go to the point where you like, again, like trying to release as well as fill up through exercise and euphoria that comes with it. Wow. And this is, I mean, really, man, I'm trying not to have like this euphoric moment this cathartic moment on air. But, you know, I think that a lot of us deal with that thing. I mean, and being able to kind of find a way to balance health and comfort, you know, in society, especially as black folk, black men, black women, and however we identify, is a huge thing that you explore while you go ahead and deal with, you know, the challenges of academia, or the challenges of dealing with being a middle schooler, you know, in a Catholic school. I love the Black Excellence section, and y'all were young trying to do that balancing.
Yeah, you know? That's my favorite section of the book. I mean, you know, because that was. That's what we were just, we had been placed in a school we weren't used to, placed in a culture we weren't used to. So what did we have? We had our bodies and we had our words and we had our play. And we tried to, and because we were in like a culture and a place that was sort of like uber disciplining of us, we kind of ratcheted up our like language, you know what I'm saying? We tried to use as many weird, you know, vocabulary words as possible in our own way. We tried to let the room know that we here, not just as bodies, but as like minds who want to talk, who want to play, who want to mess around. And, you know, that year we got lots of whippings because of our teachers' failings. You know what I'm saying? That was like the first time in my life I was like, oh, okay. So if my teachers fail me, my mama's going to beat me, because she's saying the teachers are going to fail you. The teachers are going to fail. They're going to see you as a threat. So don't give them a reason. And I remember being like, but the point is that they don't have to have a reason. They don't have to have a reason. Like being, you know, seeing big black boys talking, joking, blah, 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 blah. If you think we're threats, that's reason enough. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
So I was just trying to, I mean, the most important sentence in that thing is that, like, we tried to love and laugh each other whole. Like, and that's what we did. And that's what we tried to do for our entire lives. But, you know, again, it's interesting the way academia works. Like, we went to high school together. My friends went to different colleges. Some went to Jackson State. Some went to Alabama. You know, I went to Millsaps. And, like, that friendship that we had that kept us alive didn't keep us alive anymore. We had to find new friendships. But none of them were like that, you know, because they weren't like foundational like that. But those friendships kept me alive. That's what I wanted people to understand. And I think those friendships, sometimes those loving friendships, man, keep a lot of Black children alive. And ironically, with words, like the things we do with words.
With words. I think that is so, you know, well said. And they start very early. And I think for clarity, you all were going into eighth grade
when we changed schools. Yeah.
Right. Eighth grade. And so we're talking about 12, 13-year-old folk. So we'll get back into that. I'm talking to KSA Lehman. His book, Heavy, has dropped recently. Stick with us and give us a ring. First, a short break. Back with the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Robert Goodwin, hosting. My guest is professor and author KSA Lehman, and we're talking about his new book, Heavy, An American Memoir. You're welcome to join this conversation. Call us at 800-838-3760 or email comments and questions to jx@jeffnet.org. Okay, so we were talking about the value of friendship that starts at young ages for Black boys and Black girls, and again, however folk choose to identify.
Yeah.
But I would suggest then, and I think you have said out in the world, that those connections keep us alive throughout our lives. And I know that to be true. How valuable are your connections that are like that in your working life now as a writer and personally?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think one reason I write so much now is because those connections are less heavy than they used to be as a kid. You know what I mean? Like, I still need to listen and need to bounce words and ideas off of folks, and more importantly, listen to people bounce their ideas and words off other. I mean, I just find joy in that. But, you know, that whole thing we used to do, which is like we're just going to sit down for hours and just laugh and just talk. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's what we used to do in the face of, you know, extended Jim Crow, in the face of extended carcerality, in the face of, like, teachers who sometimes were trying their best and other times were trying their best to harm us. Like, it's just it's not the same. I can't even act like it's the same. But thankfully, I have a lot of new writerly friends who love playing with the language too. It's just like I just don't do as much playing with, like, orality, like actual voices as I used to do. I do most of my playing now on the page, mm-hmm. which I think is, you know, in some ways good for the art, but just interpersonally it's not. Like, I really do need to sit down with my folks sometimes and just, like, laugh until I can't walk. You know, like, I think that way, if I could do that every day, I'd be okay. But I haven't found a way to do that every day yet.
Well, you know, here's where I give you some, you know, more love. That's because you are becoming preeminent and a voice for the age, and probably, you know, definitely regarded in a way that, you know, some of our, you know, progenitors like the Baldwins, et cetera, you know, have meant to us. You know, right. You are in those conversations. I was listening to a conversation and reading you had with Mark Anthony Neal at Duke. And he was saying that he was kind of joking you about, you know, how you work at social media and needing to kind of watch, you know, your authenticity to say.
Right, that's a nice way to put it.
But it was because, you know, he said literally, folks find your voice compelling and defining this moment. How does that sit with you? And are you aware that you are a divining voice? That the streets is watching, you know?
You ask some great questions, man. First of all, to have Mark Anthony Neal say that to me, that was a dream. Because Mark Anthony Neal is foundational to what I want to be as a scholar, as an academic, and as a writer. But it's scary that Mark Anthony Neal would say that. You know what I'm saying? Like, because in some ways, I'm just that black boy who wakes up every morning and writes before he goes to bed, and hoping that, you know, out of 50 sentences, I can find one that sings. So it's just real strange to me anytime anybody reads anything I write or anytime anybody wants to talk about anything I've written. Like, it's just weird. It's just a weird, weird thing. I'm thankful for it. I'm so grateful for it. But I still feel, like, lucky in this way. You know, I don't know how it happened.
Yeah, I hear you. There's some things that are, like, you know, well, in my construct, I'll say divine, but just are in the best of time for us as human beings to accept and be able to receive. And I think that that's I think that's the way I look at, you know, Heavy as a piece of information, and because it's timely and folks need to hear it. And evidently it was supposed to come through you, and those pieces of information are supposed to come through you. And that's a beautiful thing. I'll just say that outright.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, most definitely. I can't get away from the fact that, you know, the amount of resonance that it had for me. And I know my crew of people who grew up comparably, mm-hmm. you know, with mothers who were very, you know, stalwart, like movement folk.
Right.
You know.
Right.
Steeped in, you know, nationalism and excellence, and wanting to make sure that their children knew where they were coming in, you know, the America that they were interacting with, but the challenge that was for them and for the youth to be reared is a huge thing. I'm gonna tell you a quick anecdote. I know I'm supposed to be talking to you and not the other way, but I'm gonna say this. So I told my mother that I was gonna be reading this book called Heavy by this brother who, you know, is an academic and writer. And she said, you know, well, what's it called? I said, Heavy, an American Memoir. And she, of course, went, you know, automatically and started looking it up. She's like, that should be really cool. And I hadn't cracked the book yet.
Mm.
And I cracked the book and started reading the first 4 hours. Like, something got me up at 4 a.m. I read from 4 to 8. And I was like, oh, my goodness. What am I going to talk to my mother about?
Oof.
I said, something had already been moving in me to go home for the holidays. But I was like, what am I going to talk to my mother about after reading, like, the first, you know, 3/4 of your book? So there are going to be a lot of folks, like you said, already said, like, there are folks coming to you, but they're going to be, you know, the work of that you've kind of put out there that you wanted the book to do, you know, is moving.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it's wonderful, right? Like, it's amazing, but it's also really scary.
Yeah.
And it's a responsibility that I want to hold. You know, I want to hold a responsibility. Part of holding a responsibility is telling folks that, like, let's talk about this and walk through this together. But if you're looking for, like, the answer or the, you know, pill that's going to make everything good, I just don't have that. I don't have that.
Right.
I got memories. Yes. and I got an art form and I got ears and I got, you know, and I would love to hear y'all's stories. But let's, like, I don't know. I just need to make sure that people understand, like, I'm not a doctor. You
right.
know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, I'm a writer. And I want to make, and I want to push us to love each other, to hold on to each other, like, in more, like, meaningful, sometimes very intimate, sensual, rigorous ways. But, and that's a lot.
Yes.
I think that's a lot.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes people want you to, like, make their families right.
Right.
And I'm saying, well, I try with that book. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
That's my attempt.
Right. I think that's the chance. I'm a storyteller by trade, and what we say when you do a story circle is that the sharing of the story is enough.
Right.
There's no need for commentary afterward.
Right.
You share stories and what resonates, and you when what you get is the lesson that you're supposed to, and you allow that to be the thing and allow the teller to have the safety to be able to, you know, share the story, and that be enough as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So tell me about you. You rep Mississippi.
Yeah, I rep Mississippi hard.
You rep Mississippi hard. Right,
I rep Mississippi pretty hard. I rep Mississippi hard partially because the rest of the nation, I think, uses Mississippi as a scapegoat. We do have specific problems that are specific to us. And most of our problems, like, stem from the fact that we are the blackest state in the nation. And there's, you know, which means most of white folk here have still not come to grips with that. So you got a lot of poor white people here who don't vote their interests, who do everything they can to harm black folk, even if it means harming themselves. But you know what? That's not specific to Mississippi. Like, that's something I see all across this country. But what we also have, partially because of what I just explained, is like a rich, rich literary tradition, fam. Like, you know, not just from Faulkner, not just from Margaret Walker, not just from Richard Wright, not just from Tennessee Williams, not just from Edgerton Knight, but even in contemporary, you know, you look at what Jesmyn Ward has done. It's incredible. Like, nobody else is doing what she's done. You look at now what, you know, you look at a book like The Hate U Give,
mm-hmm.
which everybody and their mother is talking about and reading. You know, like, that's straight out of Jackson, too. So I don't want to make it to a Mississippi appreciation. Like, I'm not trying to be, like, uncritical of my state. I think I'm super, super critical. But I also want to look at what we do well. What we tend to do well is create writers because the soil is so rich and so terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's primary source material.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you sit down to work through it, you know, even musically, like Big Crit is an artist. He's doing some amazing stuff, you know. So we can create some artists. I mean, sadly, we create the artists because social situations aren't what they need to be. But we at least are creating artists that are speaking to the world about their social situations. And as you have said, other situations that we just haven't even imagined yet, you know. Mm-hmm. So.
Okay, I'm going to ask you this question that I love asking, especially for folk who are fans of the music. If you're a hip-hop artist across the whole, who do you most align yourself with? Who is your parallel voice, you know, in hip-hop across the ages?
Across the ages? Okay, the honest answer, I got two answers. The honest answer is Jean Grey. I don't know if many people listen to Jean Grey, okay. But Jean Grey is a treasure with what she does with, like, comedy, tragedy, and resonance. But if you needed a more, like, well-known MC, I think I would. It's tough, man. I think I would have to go with Scarface or Big Crit, actually, from Meridian. But, you know, Scarface, so out the box, man. He's just talking about, I mean, I'm not in the dope game, you know what I mean? I'm not trying to mow down people with my metaphoric M16s and stuff like that. But I think the way he made mental health be front and center, and he talked about isolation and loneliness, gave me faith, you know, that I could do that too.
Mm-hmm.
Scarface is the engine that actually makes, you know, Pac, Biggie, Jay, M, all of them folks possible, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree. You chose storytellers, I notice.
Yeah.
All fantastic storytellers.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so kind of returning to the heart of the book, how did your mother respond to the, you know, your recollections?
Well, you know, she was involved in the process the whole time. So, you know, it was sometimes she was not happy with what I want to talk about, and she wasn't happy with what I wrote. Other times she was extremely happy. But at the end of the day, she just, you know, she believes in what she created. She thinks she created. She knows she created a writer, you know, a black American writer from Mississippi who is to be taken seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So that part is what I think makes her feel okay about some of the stuff that I'm saying about us that she wouldn't have said on her own. Like, she knows that I'm saying it with some integrity, with some love, with some care. You know, so that's really it. And we working, you know what I'm saying? Like, we in a better place than we were. We not delivered. We're not, everything's not hunky-dory, but we're working and we talking through hard stuff. So that's the best thing I could ever ask for, actually.
Right on, right on. In the last couple of minutes that we have, do you think she saw your gift, or do you think it was something that she just knew that was a skill?
Yeah, I didn't have, I mean, she created, that's a great question, because she created the gift. Like, I didn't have a gift. Like, I'm not, you know, I work with writers all the time. You can sometimes see those kids who actually, there's like you know, their first, second drafts are going to be amazing. I know writers in the world like that. My gift is the gift of revision, which is the gift of work, which is made necessary and possible because my mama made me revise, made me work. Do you know, like, I don't think that I have, like, the gift to see things people don't see, but I have the gift that, like, I'm relentless with a sentence, brother. Like, I'm going to rewrite that thing 15 million times, but that's not because I want to. That's because that's how I was taught. So my mama created, like, the work, which I guess can be seen as a gift, but I'm not one of these writers who's, like, born with it. You know what I'm saying? Like, I wasn't the best writer in my classes from first through 12th grade. I wasn't the best writer probably in my row. But I was relentless with the revision, which means I was relentless with the initial vision, because you got to have initial vision to have a revision. So she made that possible. Mama made this book possible. That's what I think brings it full circle. Like, she might not want some of these stories told, but I think she wants to know her son could tell them. And so I did it. She gave me this thing, and I used it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, in the last bit of time that we have, what is the thing that you want folk to get from Heavy? Last 30 seconds.
I mean, there's a lot of things, but today I'll just say, like, I just want people to really think about what it means to love black children in this country, and to think about what it means historically for the nation to have neglected and disregarded not just black children, but indigenous children in this country. And I think a love of black children necessitates a critical love of self, a critical love of family. So I'm asking everybody out there who reads this book to try to get better at loving the people they say they love, so they can then understand the people who they actually have to work harder to love, who they don't know. That's what I would say right now. So I appreciate this conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, KSA Lemon. Thank you for your work and time.